Thanks, everyone, for being with us tonight. We're talking with Peter Lance, author of the book Triple Cross. And before the break, he was telling us about a plucky FBI agent named Nancy Floyd, who managed to get an agent, a double agent, inside the terror cell that eventually caused the bomb to go off at the World Trade Center and subsequent events that led to 9/11. And if Nancy Floyd had had her way, maybe this thing, none of that stuff would have happened, because the FBI would have known about what was going to go on. It could have stopped at that point. These terror cells could have been destroyed. But in a peak of temperament or jealousy or whatever, her superior officer ordered this agent to wear a wire. He withdrew, and the rest is history. Now, we're going to take our break. When we come back, Peter Lance will pick up that story. Don't go away. I know there's a lot of names and dates to follow here, but if you can track down the timeline and see all the photos, it's easier to track all these different characters and personalities. Stay with us for more of Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Our guest, Peter Lance, author of the book Triple Cross. Peter, before the breaks, you were telling me the story about Nancy Floyd, this plucky FBI agent who got this guy to infiltrate the terrorist cell. And I don't want to overstate the significance of it, but I mean, history could be quite different if this guy hadn't been ordered to wear a wire, right?
You cannot overstate the significance of this, George, because you're very astute, because understand the following. If you believe in the great person theory of history, Ramzi Youssef is not just the Trade Center bomber, he's the architect of 9/11, and we'll get into it as we move through the timeline, that how he created this plot and set it in motion only to have it carried out by his uncle. If Youssef had been stopped in the fall of 1992, not only would there have been no original World Trade Center bombing, there would not have been a 9/11. Absolutely never would have happened, okay? I'm telling you. As God is my judge. So that's how important Nancy Floyd was. And she finally, you know, with Salem withdrew from the mosque by telling the brothers that the FBI was watching him. That's how he was able to withdraw. But he knew, he kept his ear to the ground, and he understood that something had happened. They brought this guy, Youssef, in. Now, Youssef is over in New Jersey. He's incredibly visible during this. I mean, the cell around him is incredibly visible. There's a big 6'2", red-headed Egyptian named Mahmoud Abu Lima. He's a limo driver and a cabbie. He's got a twin brother. The two of them stick out like sore thumbs. A little diminutive Palestinian named Salema. Salema is a terrible driver. He has three separate auto accidents during this period. Youssef is in a hospital, and uses a bogus phone card to order chemicals for the bomb from his hospital room. He literally is photographed at an ATM. Salema. Youssef goes into the Pakistani embassy at this point to try and get another passport. They're highly visible. But here's what's important. Abu Lima, just trace the dots. He's on the Calverton surveillance in 1989. And they photograph these guys shooting in Long Island. He's Lou Napoli and John Antisev, the two agents that are supposed to be watching Salem, who are never around, follow him, actually get a warrant and search his apartment in Brooklyn, posing as Con Ed workers, don't find anything. He boasts to the brothers outside the trial of El Sayed Nasser that he leads these hapless feds on wild goose chases up into Connecticut, okay? And he is making phone calls from payphones at the World Trade Center to a phone on Pamrapo Avenue outside of Youssef's bomb factory. And Abu Lima is delivering material for the bomb. Salema is literally living with Youssef, helping him to cook the bomb, if you will. And all the FBI had to do was do Title III wiretap on Mahmoud Abu Lima, and they would have gotten the phone outside the bomb factory. Now, and you might say, well, why would they have done that? Well, because Nancy Floyd meets with Ahmad Salem, this good undercover agent who's withdrawn, in the fall of 92 at a Subway sandwich shop near where Federal 26 Federal Plaza, the FBI office in New York. And she's giving him his last $500 because they weaned him over several months. And he says to her, there's something going on. You must follow Abu Lima and Salema. They will lead you to whoever is in town. There's a new guy in town, kind of, okay? And she said, well, look, I don't have any clout anymore. Dunbar doesn't trust me. He hates you. I'll pass it on along, but I don't think it's going to do any good. Well, listen to this. He says to her, don't call me when the bombs, plural, go off, okay? If you don't do this. Now, The bomb goes off February 26, 1993, a month into Clinton's presidency. Anticev and Napoli are in the office of Jim Fox, the aide to the New York office of the Bureau, the assistant director in charge, and Mary Jo White, the feisty little who became the U.S. attorney. She's a diminutive woman, very tough. She's pacing back and forth, pulling her hair out. What are we going to do? The FBI is literally putting out the word that Serbian terrorists did it, okay? And Youssef is actually at John F. Kennedy Airport that night in the first class lounge. Does the FBI think to lock down the lounge? No, okay? Or lock down the airport? No. So Ramzi Youssef is watching Channel 2 because they've got their transmitter on this Empire State Building, and the other two local stations around the Trade Center, they're knocked out. And he sees that the Serbian terrorist, so he calls Nidal Ayad, the Kuwaiti, who is the chemical guy who got the, you know, basically helped to get the chemicals, and he had typed the threat letter taking credit for the bombing on Ayad's computer, okay? And they mailed it as they got out of the Trade Center that morning. So listen to what Ramzi Youssef tells him from JFK to write on, and send out a new letter. Listen to this, George. Quote, "Our calculations were not very accurate this time. However, we promise you that the next time it will be very precise and the Trade Center will be one of our targets." And the FBI found that on Ayad's computer within a week or two of the bombing. Now, we're now at part two of my timeline. We're on page 10 of 32 pages. If anybody cares to download, to go to peterlance.com and download this timeline in the upper right corner. And you might say to yourself, okay, so what happened next? What happened next is Napoli and Anticev are like looking at Mary Jo White, pacing back and forth the night of the bombing. And Napoli says, well, we had a guy inside the cell. And she stops. She goes, whoa, stop. Wait a minute.
No.
You're telling me had a guy? Oh, yeah. Well, we'll get him in here tonight, tomorrow. Get him in here. Well, says Napoli, and Lou Napoli gave me this interview verbatim, okay? I got this from the horse's mouth. And Lou Napoli says to her, well, I think, you know, the guy hates us because of the way we treated him, and he's probably going to want $1 million. And she, I don't care what he wants, get him in here. So listen to this. They bring him back. This time he agrees to wear a wire. That's the only difference. But in 3 months, they set up a sting operation, and he basically wraps up this thing called the Day of Terror plot to blow up the bridges and tunnels. And they arrest the Blind Sheikh and 11 others, and ultimately convict Blind Sheikh and 9 others, including El Sayed Nasser. A second time, they convicted him, this time for murder, because when he was tried initially for the Kahani thing, he was just convicted on gun charges. Now, this is where Patrick Fitzgerald did a good thing. Patrick Fitzgerald and Andrew McCarthy were these two feds that were the principal prosecutors of that case, okay? But, George, this was a mop-up case. This case was unnecessary if they had paid attention to Ahmad Salem and Nancy Floyd the first time. Now, here's the kicker. They end up paying him $1.5 million, okay, to do effectively what he could have done in the fall of 92. And by the way, you might say, well, he was wearing a wire this time. Well, listen, all they had to do was to get another FBI agent undercover to work with him who could have sworn, if he wasn't wearing a wire, that could have sworn to what was going on, or they could have gotten Title III wiretaps. They could have made this case absolutely legally without any kind of FISA warrant or anything like that. They could have stopped the first Trade Center bombing. And this becomes very important because later, when it becomes clear to the feds in the Southern District, this is a very small universe of people. Under Fitzgerald, there are like 10 people, and under Bin Laden, there are like 10 people, and they keep intersecting, okay, over the years. In a very small universe, the feds ultimately try and take Ramzi Youssef out of the 9/11 plot by pushing it forward 2 years, and we can get into how they did that. Dietrich Snell, the assistant U.S. attorney who worked under Fitzgerald, who actually, I make the case, got the material from the Philippines on the plot in 95, they make him senior counsel to the 9/11 commission. He should have been a witness before the 9/11 commission to testify about why he didn't react to this material back in 95. So they make him the senior counsel. He pushes the plot forward 2 years, takes all the evidence that I testified to, and by the way, he took my testimony in a windowless conference room, no stenographer, no recording equipment on the 15th of March of 2004, I sent all the material from the Philippines to Governor Cain because I didn't trust Snell, and they reduced it to a footnote on Chapter 5, footnote 33, and basically they say, well, Peter Lance says the plot was in 94, but we think it was in 96. And you know who their sole source for the origin of the plot is, George? Who the 9/11 Commission uses as the basis for their conclusion that the plot was 96 and not 94?
Who?
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. I am swearing to God, who we now know is waterboarded 183 times. And when I did the piece for Playboy, which is on playboy.com/Peter Lance, you can get it right now, called The Chilling Effect, I cite Robert Windrum of NBC News, a fantastic journalist, just retired, who did a piece in May on the Daily Beast, and he went back and did a study of the 9/11 Commission report. And listen to this. One out of every four endnotes in the 9/11 Commission report, 25% of the authority that they use for reaching these conclusions on the greatest mass murder in American history were based on the word of high-value detainees tortured, okay? Meaning completely unreliable. And that's what they did to my information. They flushed it because the Southern District cannot allow the fact that they may have stopped Ramzi Youssef in 1992. And, oh, my God, here's Ramzi Youssef, the architect of the bombing. And anybody that keeps saying that Khalid Sheikh was this great mastermind of 9/11, he was a lounge lizard. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was a screw-up. I interviewed Colonel Rodolfo Mendoza of the Philippines National Police, who is the Richard Clark of the Philippines, an incredible expert on Islamic terror. And he interrogated Youssef's partner, Abdul Hakim Murad. He was a pilot trained in four U.S. flight schools, George. He was going to be the ATA, the lead pilot of the plot. There were three plots that they conceived in early 95 in their bomb factory in Manila in the Donna Josefa apartments. One, they were going to kill the Pope, who was going to come, I think, January 10th, and they were going to put bombs along his parade route. Two was this Bojinka plot, which was completely separate from 9/11 that we'll get into, that I believe was the precursor to TWA 800. And the third plot was the plane as missiles, full-blown plot. In my first book, I said there were six targets based on what I knew: the Pentagon, the Trade Center, the Sears Tower, the Transamerica Tower, CIA headquarters in Langley, and an unnamed nuclear facility. But later, I interviewed Rafael Garcia III, who's like the Bill Gates of the Philippines, who was used by the Philippines police to de-encrypt Youssef's laptop, which had all three plots on it. And he told me, Peter, there was a seventh target, the White House. And if you remember Zacharias Moussaoui, the, quote, 20th hijacker, the guy that didn't really want to learn how to land a 747 in Minneapolis, right. That guy who desperately, Harry Sammet, the great agent, tried to get a FISA warrant to search him, he said his target was the White House. And I traced the chain of custody from Camp Crema, where Colonel Mendoza interrogated Murad and got that plot out of him. I traced the chain of custody to the legal attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Manila through Sam Karmilowicz, a brilliant, wonderful, dedicated ex-diplomatic security agent who gave an interview to Alexander Coburn and confirmed what he said, that he believed that the material got to Dietrich Snell in the Southern District of New York in 1995. He saw it addressed to the Southern District, and his career, he's recently contacted me, his career has been upended by this whole thing, okay? So the point I'm trying to make is the feds were terrified. The idea that that Ramzi Youssef would be linked to 9/11 caused them to rewrite history in the 9/11 Commission. Now, getting back to Nancy Floyd, and I know I go on and I never give you a chance to jump in, but
I just want to finish this thought
on Nancy Floyd. You would think, would you not think that Nancy Floyd, who recruited, argued, and by the way, Salem was the star witness for Patrick Fitzgerald in the Day of Terror plot. Okay, he was the key to getting the conviction against the Sheikh. So now you would think, would you not, that Nancy Floyd would get a corner office in the Hoover Building, right? Because she recruited arguably the most important, asset in the history of the war on terror up until that point, Ahmad Salem. You think Nancy Floyd would have gotten an award? No. What they did was they set her up. They opened what's called an OPR investigation on her, internal affairs investigation, and they literally put her career on hold for 4 years. And somebody leaked a story to the New York Post that was headlined "The Temptress and the Spy," which tried to insinuate that she was having an affair with Salem, which is totally untrue. And the reason we know that is that Salem so mistrusted the Bureau, he was wearing a second set of recording equipment because he didn't trust the FBI after the way they treated him. It was not even a hint of anything untoward with Nancy Floyd. She's a great agent. And she ended up getting suspended, put on the street for 2 weeks. They took her shield and her gun. What was the reason? Insubordination to Carson Dunbar, this bozo of a boss who thwarted Salem and forced him out from his undercover role. Now, what message does that send to the young agents in the FBI? You know, that come out of Quantico, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, the Nancy Floyds of the world that want to do their job. She's doing double duty. She's literally working Russian counterintelligence during the day, and because Napoli and Antisev are never around, and this guy's not wearing a wire, Salem, and he has to vomit out his stuff every night, she's interviewing him at TGI Fridays at night, going up to the 26 Federal, typing up the serials, going home to Connecticut, and then coming back the next day to work Russians. I mean, this is the heroism of Nancy Floyd, and her career was basically ruined after this.
Let's jump ahead to the mob. The Colombo family wise guy named Gregory Scarpa Jr. Where does he fit in this? Explain how he becomes a character in this story.
Okay. Let's first just talk briefly about what happened in Manila. After Ramzi Youssef did the bomb, he escaped that night. He put a bomb in a Shiite mosque in Iran that killed a bunch of people, many including women. He tried to kill Benazir Bhutto by putting a bomb outside her residence. And he ultimately ended up in, first he was in Lahore, Pakistan in the early fall of 94 with Abdul Hakim Murad, his partner, doing what he called chocolate training, which is code word for explosives training. And that's when this criminal genius, this guy was trained at the Swansea Institute in Wales. He had a photographic memory. He memorized Hawley's Condensed Chemical Dictionary from cover to cover. He was a man of many aliases. He literally created his own fake passports and disguises. And Ramzi Youssef, is really running the cell in Manila. And in the cell at this Donna Josepha apartment building on the sixth floor is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, his uncle, a Murad, and a fourth conspirator named Wali Khan. And Wali Khan was beloved of bin Laden. In fact, when John Miller interviewed bin Laden, he talked about Osama Asamori was his real name. He was an Uzbeki, and they called him the Lion. He was very brave. He was kind of like the muscle guy in this cell, okay, the operations guy. So long story short, they're plotting these three plots, and this will lead us into TWA 800. And the Bojinka plot was a non-suicide plot. It was an attempt, and Bojinka, by the way, is supposedly Serbo-Croatian for big noise. How Youssef chose that term, I don't know, but apparently he'd done some time in Bosnia. In any event, Ramzi Youssef conceived this notion, and this is what a criminal genius it was. He went from a moving heavy weapons of mass destruction to be moved by truck, okay, meaning like from point A to point B, like the World Trade Center bomb, and some believe he counseled Terry Nichols on the Oklahoma City bombing, and I have a chapter in my first book, 1,000 Years Revenge, on that issue. But he went from that to designing these tiny little what I call bomb triggers. They're like blasting caps. And the concept of the Bojinka plot was that they would get on, four of them, so they'd each do like three planes apiece because there are four conspirators, and they'd get on, let's say, a United flight from Hong Kong to Singapore on to San Francisco, or another flight from, let's say, Japan to Hong Kong to L.A. And on the first leg of the flight, they would smuggle the components of it, what is really an improvised explosive device using a Casio watch timer, diluted nitroglycerin, et cetera, with 2 9-volt batteries that they'd smuggle in the heels of their shoes because they would be below the metal detectors. Youssef found that out by watching a CNN piece on metal detectors. And they basically would plant these devices over the center wing fuel tank of the plane. This becomes very important when we talk about TWA-800.
Oh, I'm going to have to hold you right there. We will come back to the TWA-800 story because I think that's of key interest to our audience. We're talking with Peter Lance about an incredible tale of skullduggery and incompetence in his book, Triple Cross. Stay with us for more on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Peter Lance, author of this incredible book called Triple Cross. And I know there's a it's a lot to absorb here. When we come back, I want to bring it back around to Ali Mohammed, the central figure in the vast conspiracy, a guy who should have been caught and I think is now in some sort of protective custody program, as well as ask the question that's on the minds of many of our listeners, and that's about the larger questions of conspiracy, whether this was incompetence or could some of this seeming incompetence have been on purpose leading to the 9/11 tragedy. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more of Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Before the break, I asked Peter Lance a question of how this tangled web of terror suspects and terror players leads to the mob. And in the course of the answer, we're getting information about a whole variety of terror plots involving this guy, Youssef. Peter, can you pick up the answer from there and then lead us to the mob? Yeah. And then I want to go back to Ali Mohammed and Patrick Fitzgerald.
Yeah, again, thank you. If you're those of you who have been following along on the timeline, we're on page 14 now. And again, I emphasize the need, the importance of going to peterlance.com and downloading this timeline and downloading below that where it's this top secret, some of the documents that are in the appendices to the book, because they will make sense to you. If, in the absence of some of this, it sounds like Tom Clancy on drugs, you know.
You need a chart, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, so I wanted to go to the I wanted to jump a little bit to the Philippines, because when Youssef was this criminal genius mastermind, diabolical mastermind, was literally the Bojinka plot, which was the middle plot that was, and then of course there was the 9/11 plot that we're going to get to. He literally did it, what's called a wet test on a Philippine Airlines 747, flight 434, December 11th, 1994. He creates the idea of a guy named Armando Forlani, an Italian national. He finds the name of this diplomat in the Windows Atlas, on the Windows of the, you know, Windows operating system on his Toshiba laptop. The reason he mimicked an Italian, because he wanted to have Catholic religious medals on him so that when he got wanded at Aquino Airport, you know, when they, you know, when he went through the metal detector, they say, oh, he's a Catholic, he's wearing medals, okay? So he has a shaving kit with him, and he's got his laptop, and in the laptop he's got some wires, and in the shaving kit, and if you go to, again, you go to this my website, or you can go to this timeline, you'll see a picture of this Casio watch, and I actually was able to get this from the lab report after they had a fire in their bomb factory in Manila. All three of these plots were interdicted, and Youssef and KSM fled to Islamabad. Youssef was grabbed a month later. KSM hung around long enough to give an interview to a stringer from Time magazine using the name Khalid Sheikh, and then he was in the wind because the FBI guy got there too late, okay? So anyway, the mastermind of 9/11, quote, leaves, escapes, and Youssef is captured. So they bring Youssef back to the U.S. They capture Murad that night. He's interrogated by Colonel Mendoza and gives up the whole 9/11 plot, which was not called 9/11 at the time, obviously, but the planes operation. And then Wali Khan escaped. They finally grabbed him. And so Youssef, Wali, and Murad, three of the four Manila cell members, are now in the MCC federal jail in Lower Manhattan. And there, first the feds are going to try them for Bojinka, and then they're going to try Youssef for World Trade One, I call it, okay, in 97. While they're in a jail cell, in the federal jail in Lower Manhattan, and only this could only happen in New York, in cell number one is Youssef, in cell number three is Murad, and in the middle is Gregory Scarpa Jr., who is a mob, junior wise guy for the Colombo crime family. Now, Scarpa's father, Gregory Sr., is the subject of my new book, which I'm doing, a fourth book for HarperCollins, specifically about Scarpa Sr., and he was a notorious killer for the Colombo crime family. In fact, in a murder trial in Brooklyn in the fall of 07, his protege, Larry Mazza, said he stopped counting after 50 murders. Now, that would make him the most prolific, almost on the level of Henry Lee Lucas, the serial killer. Do you know what I mean, George? I mean, this
yes.
is okay. So the FBI, now I have documents that Angela Clemente, this incredible researcher named Angela Clemente, filed a Freedom of Information lawsuit with James Lazar, who's the father of all, who has the assassination archives. You know, James Lazar is one of the deans of FOIA lawsuits, and they have a, they filed a lawsuit, and they've obtained large portions of Scarpa Sr.'s file going back to 1962. Director Hoover is getting copies of this file. This guy is literally giving everything to the FBI about La Cosa Nostra, the structure of the organization, long before Joe Valachi testified, George, at the hearings in 1963. This guy, a year earlier, is giving Hoover everything. Omerta, they sleep with, you know, the whole, the ritual of how we're inducted into the mob, et cetera. And he gave that to the Bureau because they gave him a virtual license to kill and steal for 30 years. And the senior Scarpa only did 30 days in prison in an incredible career of drug dealing, murder, mayhem, et cetera. Okay? Now, cut to 1996. By this irony, his son, Gregory Jr., is in this jail cell. Now, it wasn't an accident he got in the jail cell because his lawyer approached the Fed saying, look, the father's been doing good for you guys. The son is willing to risk his life and rat out these two terrorists. So they, Youssef and Murad, break away bed struts from their cells, and their little holes in the wall, and they start passing notes Youssef calls kites in between. And if you go to peterlance.com, my website, on the homepage, and I, you go over to left to the picture of Dan Rather, okay? And you scroll down, and you'll see under the section that says Major Evidence, Scarpa Jr. FBI 302 memos. And this 11-month sting of Ramzi Youssef and Murad was documented. I have 2 inches thick of FBI 302s. I have about 24 of them on this website. And if you go and you go to that section, you click on one of these 302s, you'll see that, you know, that almost day by day, certainly every 2 or 3 days, there's a memo memorializing this sting from Youssef. And if you go to the one from 3596, Scarpa advised Youssef began slipping papers to him, half sheet of paper rolled up and writing, et cetera, et cetera. Now, for 11 months, not only does Youssef, the Scarpa Jr., originally the FBI gives him a camera, George, to photograph the notes, but eventually they set up a sting operation called Roma Corporation. You know, the Bureau, I'm half Italian, I think, you know, they didn't use a lot of imagination to call it Roma Corporation. But the concept was what Scarpa Jr. sold to this terrorist genius Youssef, who no doubt had seen The Godfather. He said, well, you know, we hate, the mob hates the American government as much as you guys do. And if you allow me, I will let your people, meaning Youssef's terrorist people, you can call them from the payphone on the tier of the ninth floor tier of this jail, and you call Roma Corp, and they will patch you through to your people in New York and the Middle East. And Youssef agreed, because that, what's known as a telephone or a patch through, is a tried and true Al-Qaeda device. That's what Ali Mohammed ran one in California. Like, let's say a country like Egypt forbids certain calls to other countries. Well, they just call their Uncle Abdul at a burger joint in Texas, and he patches them through to wherever they want to go, okay? And by the way, when I don't mean to be pejorative to Arabs, there was a guy, an uncle in ran a burger joint in Texas who literally patched through the calls of Mohammed Ajaj, the terrorist who came in with Ramzi Youssef. So I'm not just making fun here. I'm telling the truth of how this works. So cut to the chase. The FBI is listening in on these calls. Youssef thinks he's calling mafia guys. And among the things uncovered in this treasure trove of evidence, A, the presence of an active Al-Qaeda cell in New York. Now, they weren't using the word Al-Qaeda, but the reason that's significant, George, is that after they arrested the blind sheikh in the summer of 93, the general feeling among the feds and the way they represented it to the media was that this threat, this Islamic threat to New York, personified by the Trade Center bombing and the Day of Terror plot, was over. Okay, we got these guys. Well, now there's evidence of an active cell. Youssef talks about having 4 people in New York. He talks about a plot to hijack a plane to free the blind sheikh, which later was considered so important that it ended up in the famous PDB, Presidential Daily Briefing, to Bush in Crawford, Texas, weeks before 9/11. There's another piece of evidence that of a link between Al-Qaeda, the Sunnis, and the Khobar Tower bombing in June of 96, thought only to have been by Hezbollah, the Shiites. Very important evidence, okay? And in the course of this evidence, if you go, again, go to peterlance.com, find that little Greg Scarpa thing under evidence on the left, and it goes to the bottom of the right-hand column, and you'll see, first of all, you'll see Casio watch detail. There's actually a schematic of Youssef's this Casio device that he used on this Philippine Airlines flight, the test that he did in 94. He gets on the first leg of that flight from Manila to Cebu in the southern Philippines, puts the thing together, goes to the seat 26K, and puts it in the life jacket pouch under the seat, wanting to have it blow down and blow up the center wing fuel tank of the plane, thinking that that's where it was. Well, Yusuf lands in Cebu, goes back to Manila, the plane goes on its way to Japan, and he miscalculated. Just as he miscalculated the placement of the original Trade Center bomb, hoping to knock Tower 1 into Tower 2, the bomb was powerful enough, George, he had blew through four floors of rebarred concrete, that it blew down. If he had put that bomb against the seawall, the three-foot-thick bathtub that the Trade Center sat in, the entire Hudson River would have come into Lower Manhattan, gone up the subway. It would have made 9/11 look like a Disney movie, okay? That was a mistake in placement, and the same thing happened here. Call it an act of God. I like to think there is a God, and that God occasionally smiles on us and has guys like Yusuf screw up. So he puts the bomb 3 feet shy. He gets off. The plane is on its way to Japan. Boom! Goes off with a little Casio watch as the timer. Kills the Japanese national, Haruki Ikegami, in the seat. They can look through and see the floor. They can see the ocean, George, down below. The heroic pilot lands the plane. Now they know if they just place the bombs 3 feet forward, they can blow up these planes, okay? So Yusuf is back in New York, awaiting trial for this Bojinka trial, which began in, I think, June of 96, and prosecuted by Dietrich Snell, the same guy I told you about, took my 9/11 testimony and flushed it, the same guy that Sam Karmelowicz believes got the material from the Philippines on the planes plot. Snell and Mike Garcia are prosecuting Yusuf, okay? You go to the PeterLance.com, and you look at these 302s, you'll see that Patrick Fitzgerald, look at the one from 3/7, 96. Here's what the first paragraph says. At the request of Gregory Scarpa Jr., the U.S. Attorney of the Eastern District of New York, Brooklyn, present at the he went to a meeting. Present at the meeting was Larry Silverman, his lawyer, Dietrich Snell, Patrick Fitzgerald, and Valerie Caproni, chief of the criminal division. So the feds are meeting with Scarpa while he's uncovering this information. And if you go to that schematic of the bomb, the Casio watch detail, it has a thing called the C-106D semiconductor. And later at trial in August, that was called Yusuf's unique signature. Nobody outside of the feds knew about that detail except for Scarpa Jr. You understand what I'm saying? And
yes.
He got it in May. Now, this is the importance. We're going to bring this back to Patrick Fitzgerald and what you talked about, that sworn affirmation, and why he may have wanted to kill my book, okay? Now, this 11-month treasure trove goes on, and because at the same time this is going on, there is a scandal in the Eastern District in Brooklyn. This is happening in the Southern District in Manhattan. The Eastern District is prosecuting, under Valerie Caproni, 75 cases in what was called the Colombo War. There was a war of succession to take over the Colombo crime family. Who was waging the war? Principally Gregory Scarpa Sr., the bloodthirsty father of this kid who's risking his life with these two terrorists. And when I said only in New York, George? So that's...
Or maybe Las Vegas.
Yeah, or Atlantic City. Anyway, that Colombo War of Succession, it was in 91-92. 12 people died, including two innocent bystanders. The agents that worked under Lynn DeVecchio, this FBI, the senior FBI supervisory special agent, known in the Bureau as Mr. Organized Crime. Okay, he was famous. He was one of the top prosecutors, the main witness in Rudy Giuliani's case. You go to, we're up on now at the bottom of page 19 of my timeline at PeterLance.com, okay? And Lynn DeVecchio was this legendary agent taught at Quantico. He was Scarpa Sr.'s, quote, control agent, okay? And what happened during, as the agents under him were investigating this Colombo War, information would come into their squad, C-10, like on a Sunday, and the next day, a guy would be dead. you know, the guy's whereabouts would be known. Suddenly the guy's dead. So they began to suspect that a leak was going on in their squad. And they literally, four agents, Chris Favo, a guy named Andich, a guy named Tomlinson, and Ledbetter, those four agents risked their career by ratting out their boss. And so the FBI in 1994 opens an OPR. Same thing Nancy Floyd was subjected to, this internal affairs investigation on their boss. Now imagine, they risked their careers. And they basically, the FBI begins investigating whether or not this DeVecchio was corrupt. Okay, now, in the course of this investigation, DeVecchio takes the Fifth Amendment. When have you ever heard of an FBI agent taking the Fifth? He refuses a polygraph, and later, after they grant him immunity, which is unheard of, why would they grant him immunity if they're trying to get to the truth and, you know, they got this guy's pension hanging over his head or worse, but they give him immunity, and later he answers, I don't recall, 66 times at a trial after granting immunity. Now, if you and I got immunity, George, and we answered, I don't recall once, a judge would jail us for contempt, okay? That's why
just to crystallize this, though, basically, you are suggesting that the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office was far more interested in busting a mob or covering mob stuff than in dealing with the terrorists.
Yeah, that is the essence of my essential finding in this. And I'm going to, before we end the night, you've got to let me tell the story of Sphinx Trading in Jersey City, because that will bring all of the relevance of all this. This is all like theoretical stuff. It's interesting stuff. But it comes home to why we should care, why the American, the people listening to you tonight worldwide should worry about the FBI's failure to reform. Their concentration, their obsession with getting the mob at the expense of taking their eye off the Al-Qaeda ball. But I'll wrap this up quickly because this section of the story is important, but I want to be able to wrap this up. So basically what I contend is this. And I have a memo, and it's this memo. Do you have the book in front of you, by the way?
I do.
Okay. Can you go to appendix. I'm flipping through as we talk here. Forgive me. Okay, appendix 5 on page 585.
I'm right there. Yep.
Okay, this is a memo from ADIC New York, the assistant director in charge, written by James Roth, who's his PLO, principal legal officer, to director Louis Free. This is from James Kallstrom, the legendary ADIC to the New York office. And basically what he's saying is with regard to, he calls him DeVecchio, he misspells his name, but with regard to DeVecchio, he says the failure, this has been going on now. This is April 10th of 96. Scarpa began giving him information, Scarpa Jr., in March of 96. So this is contiguous with the Scarpa sting of Youssef. He's basically saying the failure to reach a prosecutive opinion on DeVecchio and resolve this matter continues to have a serious negative impact on the government's prosecution of various LCN, La Cosa Nostra figures in the Eastern District, and cast a cloud over the NYO, the New York office. He's telling Louis Free, shut this thing down, Louis. We got to shut this DeVecchio thing down. So you know what they did in a matter of months after this, George? Not only did they shut down the DeVecchio OPR, they allowed him to retire with a full pension despite the failure to take the polygraph, taking the Fifth Amendment, whatever. And they then decided that, wait a minute, if we give Gregory Scarpa Jr. credibility, because he wanted to testify at his trial, his upcoming RICO trial, about this corrupt relationship with his father and DeVecchio. Greg was going to be the star witness against DeVecchio, if you will. Okay, not that DeVecchio would have been accused, but he would have been the one saying that it was a corrupt relationship. If we give Scarpa Jr. credibility on that, with this Ramzi Youssef thing, then he's got credibility, you know, against the father, against this relationship with DeVecchio. So what we're going to do is we're going to call this 11-month treasure trove of Al-Qaeda evidence a hoax and a scam. They actually floated this idea that this evidence, which is self-authenticating, you just have to look at this schematic that a 10th grade education mob guy never could have come up with it. It had to come from Youssef. And what would be Ramzi Youssef's motive to scam the feds? In these 302s, he literally has three separate murder plots. He wants to kill a federal judge, he wants to kill an FBI agent, he wants to kill Mike Garcia, the assistant U.S. attorney. So all three of those could end him up and give him more felony indictments, okay? And why would Scarpa do it? There's no reason. And that, yeah, Patrick Fitzgerald, and go to my book, Triple Cross, and go to this this sworn affirmation on page 590 to 597. Patrick Fitzgerald is talking about the Scarpa materials, which is what this treasure trove became known as. And he said, you know, we thought it was genuine at first, but then we realized it was a fabrication, a scam perpetrated by Yousef and Scarpa. It doesn't explain why they would ever do this. And he says, John Napoli was my source, our main source. Now, John, you know how I interviewed John Napoli. He totally renounced that. He said, I never told the feds that. And his interview is in my book. You know how I got to John Napoli? Through Coast to Coast AM. By talking to George Norrie one night. Listen to this, because everybody in prison is listening to this show right now. Every prison guy in a prison cell in America listens to your show, okay? So this particular night, I talk about Napoli. His sister calls me from Florida. I go to his lawyer's office, Gerald LaBush, who I believe is deceased, God rest his soul, record him, and he denounced.
Sorry, Peter, I have to stop you there. The music is playing. We got to take a break. We'll pick it up as soon as we come back. Stay with us for more of our fascinating interview with Peter Lance, author of the book Triple Cross, here on Coast to Coast AM.